Today, on Against the Grain. Until the mid-17th century, for the vast majority of Europeans, medical care was administered by women for free in the household and the neighborhood, using herbs and other formulas passed down between and among generations. Karen Blum-Gewurz illustrates how and why, only a century later, they were supplanted by men who established the basis of our for-profit medical system. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If you lived in England at the dawn of capitalism, healing and medicine were the domains of women in the home, who readily dispensed their knowledge and compounds without charge. In contrast, only a very small and wealthy minority of the population paid for the services of a household physician. By the mid-18th century, that had changed, replaced by a system of medicine for profit, which we'd broadly recognize today, one where, if you didn't have the money to pay, you wouldn't get medical care. Karen Blum-Gewurz, scholar of the history of medicine and gender, tells the story of that pivotal moment in her book, The Apothecary's Wife, The Hidden History of Medicine and How It Became a Commodity. Here's my conversation with her. Before the 17th century, what did the treatment of sickness look like in Europe for ordinary people and for the wealthy?
Before the 17th century, the treatment of illness differed for ordinary people and for the wealthy. So they did not get the same kind of treatment. And it also depended on whether you were in a country with the Catholic Church or you weren't. So if you were in a Catholic country, like say France, you could get medical care from the woman in your life, or if there was a convent or a monastery nearby, you could get medical care from them as well. If you were really wealthy, you had a physician on staff. So you traveled around from house to house or wherever you went, and there was, like you had a butler or a stable hand or a cook, you had a physician. And the physician was university trained, took classes, and treated you out of that university education. For everybody else in Europe, you got, who wasn't going to get any kind of treatment from convents and monasteries, and certainly in England, there were no convents and monasteries before the 17th century, between the 16th and 17th century, you got your care from mom, from the woman of the household that you lived in. So mom might be your own mom, mom might be the wife of your employer, mom might be the wife of your landlord, but mom was the person who knew what to do. So if you had a burn, if you had a miscarriage, if you had jaundice or palsy or an eye infection or worms or rickets, whatever, or scurvy, whatever that was, she would have a cure for you. And so the vast majority of people in Europe before the 17th century got their care from the woman in their life, and a very small, extremely affluent group got it from the household physician.
You know, we often think of the kind of treatment that's available for the wealthy being way superior to the treatments accessible to ordinary people or poor people, but how would you contrast the two of them in terms of the quality of care?
Well, it was much better to be a farmer than an earl in those days. University medicine was not very good. It was based on the writings of ancient Greeks and Romans, Aristotle, Hippocrates, Dioscorides, Galen, and your university education was basically reading them or having them read to you in a lecture, and doing whatever the book told you to do. It also involved some pretty uncomfortable procedures like bloodletting and cupping, things like that. And there was a mortality rate that attended that kind of care. One, if you're going on theory and you're not going on reality, the care does not always match up very well. And two, it's really not good for you to have lots and lots of blood taken. And that would happen from time to time. Now, on the other hand, if you were just a regular person, you were a farmer or you were a shoemaker, somebody like that, the woman in the family did not have a mortality rate. She used time-tested treatments, and if it didn't work, either it didn't clear up your problem or it killed you, she would never use it again. So the chances were very, very good that the care that you got from the woman in your life would, at the very least, not hurt you and probably do some good. But the care that you would get from your university-trained physician would be incredibly uncomfortable, sometimes painful, sometimes really painful, often debilitating, and occasionally fatal. Hence, there are these old adages, the young physician fattens the churchyard, for example. You just didn't want to go to a physician if you absolutely didn't have to. I mean, the irony, of course, is that it was very prestigious to have a physician on staff, and there was an elite level of people who thought that, of course, that was better. Nevertheless, in practice, it wasn't better. You really want to stick with mom in that case.
So then contrasting this kind of more practice-based medicine to the dogma that you've been describing, how was knowledge about herbs and preparations and different treatments for different ailments passed within this female domestic sphere?
This is actually one of the really amazing things that I think in contemporary culture we don't really appreciate, which is that things were passed woman to woman for a long time orally. Women trained the younger women in their families, the daughters, the nieces, the granddaughters, in the kitchen and taught them what to make for which illnesses and ailments and how to make it. Women taught each other what plants worked, how to grow those plants, or where to find them out in the wild. Women taught each other what tools to use in the kitchen, how long to cook something for, how to distill things. And so this was knowledge that was passed orally, one woman to the next. It wasn't just passed vertically from one generation to the next generation. It was also passed laterally among women of the same generation. Friends would share with friends, sisters would share with sisters-in-laws, people would meet up in the market. A woman might meet up in the market and go, oh, you know, my husband has this recurring eye infection. Nothing that I give him works. Do you have anything? And somebody would say something like, yeah, I've got a great treatment for it. Or her friend might say, well, I don't have it, but Mrs. Smith down the road has one, go talk to her. So it was information that circulated very freely, and it circulated among women without restriction. When you went to visit somebody, family or friends someplace else, women often shared their recipes that way too. Starting around about the 1590s, what we see is that women started to write this stuff down. So literacy was on the rise. There was a value for women's education that was modeled by the Tudor court. Paper became a little bit more available, and women started writing down the recipes. So instead of simply learning it or only learning it orally, which sometimes was passed down as poems or rhymes or songs, women were writing it down so that they could pass the book itself one generation to the next. So we have astoundingly, we have hundreds of these books left, which is amazing. And they were kept in England, yes, they were France, what's now Germany. There were recipe books in all sorts of languages from all over. And from about the 1590s to the early 1800s, you can find them. Women in the colonies, the British colonies anyway, that I know of, kept them as well. And these books would be passed generation to generation also. The knowledge would be shared. A woman would write her favorite recipe in her friend's book, and vice versa. And we have recipe books that were passed down more than a century of family life. And these were precious objects. These were important to women. Were repositories of information, but they were also a family gift. You would see the handwriting of your mother or your friend, and you'd remember when she wrote it in your book. You would remember when you were little and you saw her using the book. So these were also very personal as well as very functional objects.
You've been describing the prevailing way that medicine was disseminated for centuries in Europe leading up to the 17th century. And of course, that was a period of tremendous social change. And it included the Scientific Revolution, which is usually dated from around the 17th through the 19th centuries. I wonder if you could remind us what it was and the shift in understanding the world that it entailed.
That's a really good question, in part because scientific revolution is a popular phrase that people know, but is not a really great descriptor of what actually happened. So it's really more accurate to think of this revolution that began around in the 1550s, say, this idea as a revolution in thinking, rather than in what we would call science. It produced what we call science now, but initially it was this huge revolution in what we would agree on as fact or truth. So scholasticism was the method that educators used for centuries before that in Europe, but there was also this idea of just authority. If somebody in authority said it, that made it so. So again, if you read it in Galen, if you read it in Hippocrates, if you read it in Aristotle, it was so. This is famously one of the things that got Galileo into trouble, for example. What the Scientific Revolution did was it said, just because somebody tells it to you doesn't make it true. In order to identify truth, in order to identify knowledge, you have to go through certain processes. So you need to gather data. Just because you saw the thing happen once doesn't mean you can count on it happening. You need to see it over and over and over again, for example. You need somebody else to see it as well, corroboration. So repetition, corroboration, also testing. Somebody else should be able to do whatever it is that you do, right? So they should be able to perform the same experiment or sit on the same headland and look at the tides or turn their telescope up to the stars, whatever it is, and see or hear or smell or whatever it is, the same thing that you did. And the Scientific Revolution said the human being is limited, right? We can only see so far, we can only hear so well, we can only smell with a certain level of sensitivity. But there's a big world out there. And the Scientific Revolution said, let's use technology to help out. Telescopes, for example, microscopes, clocks, pendulum clocks, things like that began, were either invented or they were turned to a slightly different use, right, in the search for knowledge. So the scientific revolution is basically saying it's true if I can prove that it happened and you can prove that it happened, and it doesn't matter what either one of us or anybody thinks. Now, partly what's amazing about that, aside from everything else, is that it supposes or assumes that the more knowledge you have, the better, but also the more knowledge you have, the more you may have to change your mind. So you've got a certain amount of data. Great, that explains something. When new data comes in, the explanation may not fit anymore. And what the scientific revolution says is, then the problem is with the explanation, and you need to go back, take all the data, and figure out what all of the data taken together says. So initially, we might have thought one thing, but now that we've got all of this other information, now we need to put that other thing aside. It doesn't fit, and we need to think about something else. If anybody is following, for example, what's going on with the Webb telescope, for example, the headlines are constantly, astronomers have to rethink, right? Or new ideas about are constantly coming in because all of this amazing new information, new data is coming in. And all of these ideas that we had about the universe, about physics, based on the data that we had before, doesn't work anymore. The scientific revolution brought in a way of thinking that was about being curious, about testing, about agreeing to modify when more information came in. It emphasized collaboration. And so it was a tremendous change from the old line, you know, if you see it in the sun, it's so. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, you know, right? So it's a big change from that. This idea that somebody says it, therefore it's true. Now we have somebody says it. What data do they have? Why do you believe that? And when new data comes in, what do we do with that data? Does it fit the explanation or not?
Which all, of course, sounds fantastic. And tremendous progress in terms of a way of seeing the world based on dogma or based on information that is anecdotal, etc. But as you're arguing in The Apothecary's Wife, The Hidden History of Medicine and How It Became a Commodity, it's more complicated than that. How did the scientific revolution transform the understanding and practice of medicine?
Really happened in two stages, I would say. One is the scientific revolution brought in a bunch of ideas and a bunch of procedures and brought in or enabled the transformation of medicine from something that you got at home, something that you got for free, something that you got because you were a human being. So essentially, medication as a human right, into medication as something that you paid for, and therefore medication as a commodity. And if it's a commodity, then it can't be a human right. Human rights are not things you pay for. Human rights are things that you have. They inhere in the person, or they're gifted to you by the government, whatever your theory is. So what happened with the practice of medicine is that the scientific revolution came in and said, we have this great system for figuring out how things work and for testing whether they really do work. And so the first stage was bringing the system to bear and sort of establishing ways of using this system of thought, the system of establishing truth, bringing it to bear on medicine and medication itself. Right. So we can see this in this staggeringly amazing efflorescence of anatomy. William Harvey discovering or establishing the circulation system, which nobody had really ever figured out before. Why not? Because they had not devoted 10 years of their life to dissecting everything under the sun and establishing how circulation worked. So one thing then was this amazing expansion of our understanding of how the human body worked, what connected with what was in there, how it worked. Neuroscience is born during this time, and this is all amazing. When it comes to medication, the scientific revolution brought in this idea of we really should figure out what it is in the thing that makes it work. And in fact, we should really use our new systems to figure out if it does work at all. So you see people, adherents of the scientific revolution, people working with what became chemistry, for example, testing medications and going, you know, this is bad for you. The secret formula that this person is using actually has arsenic in it and mercury and antimony. And those things are really, really bad for human beings. Do not ingest. Also, by the way, do not eat silver or drink silver. That's not good for you. So stage one was people using ideas about the scientific ideas from the scientific revolution to begin figuring out how human beings worked, how medication worked, and how this knowledge could be used. But it also provided people with an opportunity to say, medicine that is created by these processes, or that is validated by these processes, is superior to medicine that you get at home from mom, because mom's medicine has not been created by this stuff. It's not synthesized in a lab. It hasn't been tested by chemists. And so it created an opportunity to create a commodity and to create a market and to control the market for that commodity. What happens after that is that science actually starts making better medication. So the transformation of medication into a commodity predates scientific or professional medication actually being better, because all this time, the professionals and the moms are making the same stuff from the same ingredients. They may be processing it slightly differently. Mom might distill it once. An apothecary might distill it six times, which, by the way, would weaken it considerably. So you still want to go with what mom's making. But you have this transformation, this creation of a market before you have a transformation of the medication. And then in stage two, what you get is this transformation of medication. And that's how, for example, we go from having wormwood, which has salicin in it, to having salicylic acid and aspirin. Because chemists finally extracted the thing from wormwood that actually made your headache go away. And they figured out how to create that as a substance that you didn't have to drink 9 gallons of wormwood tea or whatever you were getting your wormwood from. And you could just take the essence of the wormwood and that would make your headache go away. So medication became much more efficient, much more effective, but after it became something that you had to pay for, after it became exclusionary to some people, because they couldn't pay for it.
The period that you're describing is the period of enclosure. It's the period in England in the mid-1600s, following the Civil War, when groups like the Diggers argued that the Earth's gifts were a common treasury for all. How much of what you're describing can be attributed to the emergence of capitalism and the enclosure, the privatization of what had been held in common?
Capitalism as an idea is developing and facilitating the transformation of medication into a commodity, something to be bought and sold, but also the innovations in the transformation of medication into a commodity greatly advanced capitalism. So it was a mutually supportive development on either side. My first book for academics is on the figure of the widow in the early English novel and how she represents the anxiety about the development of capitalism and also imperialism, which is a huge part of the development of medicine and medication during this time. How do I see the creation of medication as something to be bought and sold, and the creation and then the policing of that market in relation to capitalism? I think it's very much enabled by capitalism. the concept that you could do that, the growing acceptance that things could be paid for, international trade, especially imperialism, let's just go someplace, kill all the people who are there and take all their stuff. I'm greatly simplifying, but essentially, all of those things are facilitators of the creation of a medical marketplace and the normalization of a medical marketplace. At the same time, if you are living in a time when you are surrounded by people saying the best stuff is the stuff that you pay for, you shouldn't get this shoddy stuff from home, you should buy this great stuff from this other person. When you're surrounded by that, it normalizes also other ways the capitalism is coming in. So one of those things, right, is the diggers, also the levelers, this idea of enclosure. And these are all movements that are promoting the idea of private property rather than collective property, private good as opposed to collective good. And they're being resisted in lots of different ways. But, you know, we're alive today, so we know that that resistance didn't go too well. So, yes, I think those are phenomena that the rise of capitalism, ideas of enclosure, of privatization, of medicine as a thing that's bought and sold, as the knowledge of medicine as something to be bought and sold. That is all a cyclical development where I don't think you can pick one point of entry and say it begins here. The 17th and 18th centuries is an absolutely staggering time not just the development of capitalism, right, but for a whole transformation of the globe, so that other peoples are brought into a system that they wouldn't necessarily want to be part of.
Right, and precisely from the mid-17th to 18th centuries, you argue that this transformation took place in a relatively short period of time when the long-standing knowledge of women around medicine, which was not commodified, which was part of the commons of medical knowledge, that changes. And I wonder if you could tell us who ended up supplanting the women in the domestic sphere, including entities like apothecaries that had existed simultaneously with women's domestic knowledge around medicine, but then was transformed during that relatively short period of time.
Domestic medicine was practiced by women. So as a cultural institution, everybody was part of it, but the actual medicine was made and dispensed, and the knowledge of medicine was transmitted among and between women. So that's why it's so female associated. So who pushed the women out and who was able to fill that vacuum, or who pushed the women out in order to create a vacuum that they could enter, is the professionals. It's the apothecaries and the physicians. Now, as you point out, they were around all this time. Their problem was that people recognized that one, the thing that you got at home was generally better than the thing that you got outside of home. And two, the thing that you got for free was always better than the thing that you paid for because it was free. And if you've got a raging fever, the last thing you want to do is put on your shoes and your coat and go out in the snow in order to go down the street to a physician who will suck some blood out of you with his leeches and then send you to an apothecary where you get something that you don't even know how it's made. And then you go home again through the snow feeling horrible, which is the system pretty much that we use now, right? So the physicians and the apothecaries used the scientific revolution as their lever to push domestic medicine and therefore women out and in order to put themselves in. So they discredited women's knowledge. Mom means well, or mom is actually an evil crone with warts on her nose and green skin who brews this scary stuff in cauldrons in the forest, take your pick, means well, but is going to kill you, or doesn't mean well and is still going to kill you. So her knowledge is not reliable. So we have a discrediting of women's knowledge, a limiting of women's access to this knowledge, a regendering of the knowledge. Oh, you shouldn't know about all this stuff with tongs and stills and alembics and that stuff. That's all equipment that really belongs to men. The kitchen is really for making bread and poaching fish and candying violets. It's really not the place where you come up with that burn salve or that heartburn medicine. Those medications belong in a laboratory, which is male space. Creating spaces that were associated with men, limited to men, and designed for the creation of medication are all strategies for pushing domestic medicine out of the way. And along with it, of course, you get this revaluing. Medication is something to be paid for. It's too bad some people are going to die. Sorry about that. It is unfortunate, but you know, it's normal. And people had to learn that it was normal and unobjectionable, were sufficiently unobjectionable that we put up with it, that people can't afford medication.
And it seems like that was part of a larger shift about having knowledge become private property, that the shift toward having it be just the way it is, that medicine is something that you have to pay for, and perhaps some people can't pay for it, is rooted in a deeper assumption about knowledge. Can you talk about that also as it relates to the scientific revolution? You have a rather amusing description of a letter that Isaac Newton sent, which I would not be able to sum up for you right now.
That's sort of the perfect example. Somebody asked Isaac Newton whether he was developing a mathematical system that we now call calculus, and he sent back a string of letters and numbers that was an extremely encoded Latin saying that was one sentence explaining the entire idea of calculus. And the reason why he did that was he didn't want anybody else to beat him to the development of calculus, which from our perspective, now we know that between Newton and Leibniz, there was quite a battle, and scholars still argue about it. It looks like Leibniz might have been ahead of Newton, but Newton accused Leibniz of stealing from him, and then Robert Hooke accused Newton of stealing from him. And it's a perfect example of keeping knowledge to yourself because you don't want to be scooped. Knowledge has value. It always has value, right? I have this great cure. I can help you with your heart palpitations, or I can set your leg, or I can restore your eyesight. So that kind of knowledge, incredibly valuable always because of the good that it can do. But one of the things the scientific revolution did was it put a premium on who came up with the knowledge. So you got to name body parts after yourself if you were the first one to find them, which is why women have so many reproductive organs with men's names attached, like fallopian tubes and the pouch of Douglas, because it was all men doing the anatomy and they were like, oh, I found this fabulous thing. I'm going to name it after me. And, you know, that's a little bit weird if you think about it, right? However, the idea was that everybody should sing your praises and give you credit for coming up with the idea. And so that's a privatization of knowledge. Newton came up with calculus, or Leibniz came up with calculus. William Harvey discovered the circulation of blood, right? All of these things. So it becomes a thing that you own and that somebody has to pay to get access to, and that payment might be buying the journal in which you publish your findings. It might be paying tuition to go to the class, paying for the book that explains the idea. But there is always some kind of value of prestige and perhaps also money, attached to knowledge at this point. So different from domestic medicine, which regarded knowledge as no one's property, but the whole point of knowing things was to use it and to share it. What we see now, right, is, again, this is fairly normalized for us, but it was a really big deal when lots of knowledge became privatized. So we think about, say, the patent system for things like molecules. I mean, whoa, molecules? But yeah, there's a patent system that includes medicinal compounds. Those things are considered private property. People in universities have to sign contracts with their university, granting the university certain rights of ownership to whatever their findings are. That's standard in the STEM fields. The humanities are spared. Apparently, nobody wants what we have to say. So it was a really important thing. And of course, famous scientists, that's a value, but they gained from it, right? They gained medals. They gained well-paying positions. They gained accolades. I mean, there were scientists in the 17th and 18th century, it's so hard to believe now, but there was fan merch about certain scientists. There were medals with Edmund Halley's face on them. You could go and you could buy mugs with Isaac Newton's profile. It's pretty nifty to be that person. And also, you got plenty of money from it as well.
Karen Blum-Gewirtz is my guest. We're discussing her book, The Apothecary's Wife, The Hidden History of Medicine and How It Became a Commodity. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And what you were just talking about, this privatization of medicine, of course, and knowledge broadly, also, of course, elides the collective knowledge that goes into any discovery or anything that anybody learns or figures out, you know, the last sort of step in it. How much controversy did this whole orientation spur in this period around the commodification of medicine, of taking knowledge that was free and putting a price on it? Because obviously it meant that people who could not afford to pay for medicine stayed sick. And, you know, sometimes the wealthy can justify that easily and think of those people as out of sight, out of mind. But when there are plagues or other things where sickness spreads, that actually can affect people who try to sequester themselves away from the rabble.
So the first thing is, we use the term revolution because the scientific revolution was just this incredible volcanic moment. I mean, a really long moment, but a moment. And initially, and this is something from our perspective that seems sort of amazing, initially it was considered really fringe, like all the major scientific organizations that we think of now were basically men's clubs of people who got together, and everybody else thought they were kind of kooky and crazy. Jonathan Swift actually has some wonderful satires of experiments that the Royal Society was doing in Gulliver's Travels in Book 3. He thought they were absolutely ridiculous, and this whole thing was just bonkers. So initially, in fact, the whole idea of doing experiments and getting knowledge this way seemed pretty ridiculous, especially because it was overturning hundreds and hundreds of years of received wisdom. What do you mean that the earth is not the center of the cosmos? What do you mean that the heart is actually the thing that makes blood go? What do you mean that thought comes from the brain and there are nerves? You know, so it was really, the whole thought system was considered really radical. So the first resistance actually is to just the idea that knowledge should be acquired and verified this way. And then there's the specifics of the circumstances with medicine. It's not inextricable. The two of them are really tied. And there were physicians who thought that this new scientific medicine thing was cuckoo. And in fact, the Royal College of Physicians in London was very conservative. That they were not where the breakthroughs in medicine were coming from. Actually, that was the Royal Society that was doing all the breakthroughs and the innovation. So on the one hand, you had a great conservatism on the part of the establishment, as it were. This way of thinking is nuts. These discoveries are crazy. Everybody knows that the four humors make the body go. What's with this heart pumping thing? William Harvey got called an accountant by one of the great anatomists in Europe, which I just love. It's like, no, it's not. He's not an accountant. He spent 10 years dissecting things. But the guy goes, listen, 582 earthworms. He's an accountant. So there was a real a suspicion of all of this. And when it came to medicine, then some of the initial resistance was just this: these ideas come out of nowhere and they're crazy, and trying to find out what the curative property of wormwood is or anything else is foolish. Right. There's I write about this in the book. We have James Douglas's laboratory notebook, and he hired a private laboratory, and there was such a thing for a long time in London. He hired a private laboratory to conduct a series of experiments to try to identify what the curative properties were of certain things. And page after page after page in this notebook is, we got this thing, but we don't know what it is. Experiment after experiment ended with, we got a red liquid, but we don't know what it is. We got, you know, a white powder, but we don't know what it is. We don't know if it does anything. We don't know what it is. So there was that. There was also the resistance to this sort of rise and dominance of these people who had a terrible reputation. Mom doesn't do cupping, mom doesn't do leeches, and mom's patients survive a lot better than the physician's patients. Why should the physicians be the ones in charge? So there was a lot of resistance there too. The persuasion aspect of the change is truly spectacular. It's really remarkable, and proponents of the scientific revolution used a lot of different strategies to persuade people to accept their mode of thinking, and with it, their kind of medicine. Our kind of thinking is superior because it follows this system. We can verify. It involves books and experts. We check each other to make sure that our work is good, right? Stuff like that. And also, this stuff is so amazing and smart and special that ordinary people can't even understand it. That's how incredibly great it is. And we're living with the legacy of some of that now, right? That there are plenty of perceptions that science is hard, that it's too hard for girls, that ordinary people can't understand this stuff, and so they shouldn't even bother. They should just accept whatever scientists tell them. Right? This is the legacy of those that campaign. So there was really a push, and there was some resistance, but it was a very concerted push. It had a lot of support from authority figures, Parliament, the royal family, the aristocracy, the richest and most famous physicians of the day, the richest and most famous apothecaries of the day, and all of those forces together really pushed it forward with a certain inevitability. I mean, we still have suspicion of science, right? And there are jokes about how physicians have terrible handwriting and nobody can read it. And that originates in part from the apothecary's code that they used to keep other people out of knowing what they were doing. But it became, I don't want to say a juggernaut, but it became incredibly difficult to resist. It was coming in from the effort to persuade people was coming in from so many directions on so many fronts, using so many different strategies.
Looking from the present back at this history, as you do in part two of The Apothecary's Wife, The Hidden History of Medicine and How It Became a Commodity, how do you see the lineages of our for-profit system of medicine today, which often is attributed to the power of entities like the big pharmaceutical industry with all of their lobbyists and so on. How much of that can we actually see as being rooted in the commodification of the knowledge and practice of women in the domestic realm up to more or less the 17th century?
I am tempted to do the unscholarly thing and say everything, but I'm pretty sure as a scholar that is not actually a correct answer. So what I will say as a scholar is that the practices, the system, and the values that constitute for-profit medication in whatever form, take big pharma, take the generics industry, anything like that, has in some way a touchstone in the transition that I talk about. Is it inevitably the complete descendant? Again, scholars never say everything is, but there is certainly a continuity of value and a continuity of practice or system that, despite whatever changes any given country might have made at one time or another, remains. So the idea that we pay for medicine in the United States is really well entrenched. So entrenched, in fact, that we think of health insurance as the gateway to medical care, because medication itself and medical care, going to get your tonsils out or having a physical, is too expensive. And so we pay into health insurance to make that possible. In fact, health insurance companies, their business is not making it possible for people to get medical care. Their business is getting people to buy health insurance. Totally different business, which creates huge financial conflict. There was a time in the commodification of medication when people recognized the problem with doing this and considered what to do. I mean, we have the writing, we have the different kinds of institutions, and eventually there was no real effort to create a system in which people had access. And so we've really inherited that. So what's necessary is a combat of values, not just systems, but of values. So, for example, if you take, the UK with its NHS and national healthcare system, the theory there is governments take care of their citizens. Providing healthcare is one of the things a government does. That's its job. You pay taxes, we help take care of you. We have an army, we have a navy, we have a public health service. That's what we do. That is a strong modification of a system that initially said everybody pays. In the United States, that's not the value. There is not a theory that government exists to protect the citizenry's health. So we see elements of government like Medicare or Medicaid, and I would argue things like the SNAP program, farm subsidies, things like that. Those are efforts to use government to protect citizens or to facilitate the well-being of citizens, but it's in absolute opposition to a theory that says government should let business do what business does, and that means medication is a commodity that you pay for. And I'm sorry you died because you rationed your insulin, but I'm not really sorry you died because you rationed your insulin. So in the sense that we see this huge value shift, we see the creation of a system, and we see the creation of medication as a totally different concept, I would say, yeah, we're living with the legacy of that. We're living with today's incarnation or version of it here anywhere on the planet, but certainly in the United States, especially, it's in a particularly, I think, clear form. Now, that's not to say that there aren't also elements of domestic medicine that we see in play. Arguably, the theory that the health of the citizenry is of value to the nation, the community cares what happens to members of the community, is part of ideas like the NHS, and there are a lot of governments around the world that have some version of universal health care. It's not just Britain, right, or Canada, and they all have certain things in common, but they are all distinctive to the country that created them. But we still do have ideas from domestic medicine. They're not gone forever. And I talk about this in the book, but one of my favorite examples is iodized salt, which is so unglamorous. And people are like, what? But iodized salt is a great example of where private interest, corporate interest, and public health came together. And corporate interests said, we've got a product that's good for people. And if people use our product, they are healthier. And so they do more work, they defend the nation, and they have more money to do things like buy another box of iodized salt. So there are certainly places where we see domestic medicine still in play. But yes, absolutely. I think there's no doubt that the system, that the values are the legacy of what happened in the 17th and 18th century.
Karen Blum-Gewirtz, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Karen Blum-Gewirtz is the author of The Apothecary's Wife: The Hidden History of Medicine and How It Became a Commodity. She's a scholar of the history of medicine and gender. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.